Another Starliner delay, and an update from Mars. You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Before launch, Boeing Starliner sprung a small helium leak, but it was cleared for launch. Now in orbit, more leaks have been discovered, and other issues with the spacecraft's thrusters have propped up. As NASA and Boeing review new data, they're delaying the return of the capsule with two NASA astronauts to no earlier than June 26th. We'll speak with space analyst Laura Forsick about Starliner's issues and Boeing's future amidst the problems. Then, our robotic explorers on Mars have been very busy. We'll speak with mission scientist and University of Florida astrobiologist Amy Williams about Curiosity and Perseverance, and what answers lie on the surface of the Red Planet. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Boeing Starliner has had multiple issues since launching earlier this month, including faulty thrusters and helium leaks. The crew's new landing date has been pushed back to at least next week, much longer than the initial 8-day stay. Boeing and NASA are confident that the issues will be resolved and that the vehicle is safe to return the crew. But how will these issues affect the future of Boeing Starliner spacecraft long term? Well, here to answer that question and to discuss Starliner's malfunctions is Laura Forsick, space industry analyst and founder of the consulting firm Astrolytical. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, as always, for having me.
So, Laura, it feels like we've been talking about this mission forever because it keeps getting extended. What do we know about the state of Starliner as we record this on Monday?
Not only extended, but it took a while to get here. So Starliner is finally docked to the International Space Station after many years of delays. And unfortunately, we are seeing some issues pop up. Nothing that is crucial or life-threatening, but there's just additional tests that need to be done on Starliner as it is docked to the ISS. We did see it delay its docking. So we know that there are bugs being worked out at the moment.
Let's talk about those bugs, because you mentioned there's not much concern here, but it does sound a bit scary, right? I mean, there's helium leaks, issues with the vehicle's thrusters. What do we know about these problems, and why aren't NASA and Boeing too concerned about it just yet?
Well, as of right now, there are three human-rated capsules on the International Space Station. So if there was anything that was critically wrong with Starliner, there would be two additional ways for the crew to get back down to Earth using Soyuz and using the SpaceX Dragon. And so there's nothing to worry about here. And there's no one saying that they can't use Starliner to return back to Earth, but they want to make sure. They want to make sure that these leaks aren't going to cause problems. They want to make sure that everything is operational the way they expect. And because this is a demo mission, they want to make sure that they get the data they need for additional missions, because Starliner is not a one-off capsule. It is meant to do 3 to 6 additional missions to the International Space Station, and I'm sure Boeing is hoping that it will continue its missions beyond that.
As you mentioned, this Boeing Starliner is going to be an operational vehicle. It's going to spend roughly a half a year docked to the space station as well. Can engineers at Boeing and NASA take this as, hey, this is just another opportunity for us to really stress test this vehicle ahead of operational missions?
There are certainly some things that can only be done while on an active mission, while in space. And so the engineers and scientists on the ground tested this thing as much as they possibly could. But the fact that this is a demo mission meant that they needed to test things that can only be done on space station, in space, docked to space station. And right now, there's the extra concern, the extra cautiousness, because there's two human lives on board. There's two astronauts that came aboard ISS that are expecting to leave ISS through this capsule. And because it's not an uncrewed mission like the last Starliner mission, they just want to make absolutely certain that the crew can safely get back to Earth using this same capsule.
Laura, you mentioned the helium leaks. I believe there's 5 discovered now, but there was a leak before launch, and NASA said, and Boeing said, it's not an issue, we can still fly. Do you get the sense that this mission was pushed through or launched when it truly wasn't ready to launch? Could these issues have been avoided?
Yes, the issues could have been avoided, but when it comes to spaceflight, nothing is ever 100% safe. And so what they did was look to see what the data told them. Is this crucial? Is this something that we can live with? And is it within tolerances? Now, I don't know if they had detected 5 helium leaks, whether they would have launched. That is something for the engineers to decide for the next mission. But you can rest assured that they're going to be looking at this very closely to make make sure that they understand why these leaks are happening and how to fix it for the future.
Butch and Sunny are getting some extra time at the station. I'm sure they're not too upset about that, that they get to spend some extra time in space. But are they just hanging out and waiting for them to get the go-ahead to come home? Or what is kind of keeping Butch and Sunny busy during these return delays?
The great thing about this mission is that these are two veteran astronauts. So they have already been on board ISS before. They are well-versed in how to operate on space station, and they've got a job to do. So they're the ones who are up there being the eyes and ears and testers for the engineers on the ground. So not only are they working on Starliner in particular, but they're also doing their own work, like gravity research, things that astronauts are well-trained to do. And there's a reason why they put veteran astronauts on this mission, on this demo mission, is because they're the ones who don't need that adjustment period so much to adjust to living and working in space. They can really get the job done.
Let's talk a bit about their trip home, whatever that may be. Is there concern that there is, like, is this helium and these thrusters needed to come home? And could that be a concern for the crew and mission managers in planning for that?
I would not be concerned at this point. We have no knowledge that the Starliner capsule that is docked to the ISS is not safe for them to fly back. We just cannot assume that at this point. At this point, all they're doing is additional testing, and perhaps they need to do a fix while, you know, it's docked to the ISS, or perhaps it's fine the way it is. And if there is something, if they decide that they cannot use that capsule to return the astronauts back, they're going to make adjustments. They've got two additional vehicles types that they can come back on, SpaceX and Soyuz. And that is why we have this dissimilar redundancy. This is exactly why NASA chose two service providers for Commercial Crew Program, SpaceX and Boeing, is because if one ends up having issues, the astronauts can use another one.
I want to get back to that dissimilar redundancy in a minute, but I do want to ask you what the optics would be if, in the very slim chance, they're not able to return in Boeing Starliner capsule and Butch and Sunny have to use a different capsule. That is not a good look for Boeing and the Starliner program, is it?
Absolutely not. No. So this has already been an embarrassment for Boeing for a few years now. Boeing has lost money on this because it's a fixed price contract. That means that all the delays and all the problems, Boeing is eating that money. And not only that, but just the different issues, the tape and the various valve issues. Like, it's all been a bit of an embarrassment to Boeing, which has a very long history in spaceflight. And so when this mission, when the Commercial Crew Program was initially conceived, Boeing was the front runner. They were the ones who were assumed to have, success because they have that long success history. But it hasn't turned out to be that way. Boeing has really struggled with this Starliner capsule and just understanding how to do this safely, which unfortunately might be a continuation of Boeing's larger problems with quality control.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Laura Forsick about Starliner's delay, malfunctions, and the journey to get the crew back to Earth. You can't not draw the parallels, right, to Boeing space and Boeing's jets and Boeing's commercial airlines, right? I mean, is this pointing, you kind of alluded to, a larger problem within the organization itself? And are there changes that need to happen?
It very well could be. I'm not an expert in the aviation side of Boeing, but we do know that there have been significant quality control issues and personnel issues. And it could be that those same issues that Boeing has struggled with on the aviation side are, transitioning or bleeding into the space side, which is very unfortunate because we understand aviation a lot more than we understand spaceflight. Aviation is fairly routine now, whereas spaceflight is not. And these are vehicles that are experimental. And whenever you have something that's experimental, you really need to have the best people on board and the best testing. And thankfully, NASA is ensuring that Boeing is operating safely. And so NASA is going to do everything it can to make sure that its astronauts return back to Earth safely. So between Boeing and NASA working together, I have no fear that these astronauts are going to come back safely. We just don't know when or how.
And as you mentioned, this is an important mission to certify Starliner because NASA wants dissimilar redundancy. What does that mean? And how does this mission help accomplish that?
Absolutely. So if you think back to the space shuttle, and the space shuttle was operational for a couple of decades, but it was the only U.S. vehicle that was operational, that was capable of taking humans to orbit. And we saw when there were incidents with space shuttle, there were tragedies. The space shuttle program froze for a number of years. You know, there were different periods of time where they had to stop the program to understand what went wrong and why there was a casualty or several casualties. And we don't want that. We don't want progress to stop. We don't want there to be casualties at all. So whenever there's a problem that pops up with a vehicle, we want to understand that before there's a tragic accident. And we don't want spaceflight to just stop just because there is something going wrong. We want to be able to continue. And that's the idea with dissimilar redundancies. You've got two commercial service providers, SpaceX and Boeing, and you've got two different vehicles, the Crew Dragon and the Starliner. And understanding how they both work and understanding that if there's a problem with one of them, the other one can continue. So we don't have to rely on the Russian Soyuz, which unfortunately is what we had to rely on from 2011 when the space shuttles were retired to 2020 when Crew Dragon started operations with a Demo 2 mission to the ISS. And that was a long period of time where the United States was relying not on any U.S. vehicle to get its astronauts to the International Space Station. And we don't want to see that again.
This Starliner mission is the crew flight test. It's a test. What are the next steps to get Starliner operational so that NASA does have those two providers in dissimilar redundancy, which they have wanted since the start of the commercial crew program?
If it turns out that these helium leaks and whatever other issues they are working are no big deal, then I can imagine that the next Starliner mission would be an operational mission. You know, Starliner 1 is what they're calling it. If it turns out that there are more problems than they conceived and they need to do more testing, I could very well see that there be a second crewed demo mission, just like there was a second uncrewed demo mission. So there was only one uncrewed demo mission conceived, but because of all the issues with that first Starliner uncrewed demo, they decided to add another one. And if NASA decides that Boeing is not safe when it comes to the mission that they're currently doing, it might be that NASA demands that there be another demo mission before they consider the vehicle ready for operations.
And this would all come at the cost of Boeing, right?
Exactly. Yes, that's the difference between a cost plus program and a fixed price program. Cost plus means that NASA would eat all those delays. You know, NASA would pay for it. NASA would pay for any problems. But that's not what this program is. This was conceived as a firm fixed price program where Boeing is the one who is, you know, paying for the fact that it's messing up.
And finally, Laura, let's look at the glass half full. I know you mentioned some of the advantages of having an extended mission here, but I've got to imagine the engineers at both Boeing and NASA are excited to get a lot more data on this vehicle now that it has spent much more time in space. Walk me through just how much more data they're able to collect because of this.
So this mission was only initially conceived to be about a week long. And I actually think it's a good thing that they're getting more data while in space, because there's only so much testing you can do on the ground. And there's only so much testing you can do when you have dummies on board, not actual people. Hopefully it'll turn out that these additional tests on board can give them the information they need to ensure that the next vehicle, the next mission is perfectly safe and goes without a hitch.
And we get more pictures and videos of Butch and Sunny having a good time.
I'm sure they appreciate the fact that they get an extended stay on the space station.
We've been speaking with Laura Forsyk. She's the executive director and founder of Astrolytical, a boutique space consulting firm specializing in emergency space industry technologies and trends. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
Still to come, drilling on Mars. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. From solar storms to new discoveries, the Mars rovers Curiosity and Perseverance have been working tirelessly to uncover more history that lie on the surface of Mars and beneath it. Here to talk about the rover's plans and the latest news from the Red Planet is Amy Williams, a member of the rover's science teams and astrobiologist at the University of Florida. Well, Amy, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you so much.
So it's been a while since we've talked about Perseverance and Curiosity, but before we get to that, I want to talk about a headline that a friend of mine sent me, a news story. He's a listener of the show, and the headline was Frost was discovered on Mars. This is a pretty big deal, right?
So yeah, water is always a big deal on Mars, and frost that is actually water ice is always a big deal. These are incredibly thin. Like we're talking about like a hundredth of a millimeter thick. So like these are, you know, you're not picturing, you know, a nice frosty New England morning. You're really picturing something that you'd be hard pressed to detect with the naked eye. But yeah, any indication of an active water cycle on Mars is always really exciting. You know, we've found frost previously with other missions, but every indication is a really exciting discovery.
And this is on a volcano called Olympus Mons. Is that a place that you can easily get to with one of your robotic explorers, or is this something that we're going to have to keep an eye on from the sky?
Eye in the sky kind of situation. So Olympus Mons is the biggest volcano in the solar system. So it is a big hit with my small child who loves volcanoes and also loves Mars. But yeah, this is not something that we couldn't rove to it from where our rovers are, and we would have quite the time trying to climb it if we wanted to do that. So this is where our orbital assets are super powerful for helping us understand, you know, so much more about Mars than we can ever explore on the ground.
Well, Amy, I know you've been focusing on other work, but when a finding like this does come out, if you get an observation from an orbital asset, how does that, if at all, change the way that you do groundwork with Perseverance and Curiosity?
Oh, so I mean, we rely so much on our orbital assets to provide the information about where we're going, where we want to go. So we see things from orbit and say, that looks interesting because X, Y, or Z. And then from the ground, we're able to refine that and decide, all right, well, X looks more interesting for these reasons than Y. So then we'll go there. But it's always a game of comparing our ground truth to our orbital observations and trying to bring them more in alignment, because that always helps you make better predictions down the road when you can say, okay, this is what it looked like from orbit. This is what it actually was on the ground. Now let's bring those together to make better predictions about where to go, both with our existing on the ground assets as well as future missions.
Well, let's talk about the, I guess not boots on the ground, but you've got those rovers, the wheels on the ground, right? So let's talk about them because it has been a while since we talked about the mission, Amy. And since then, you know, we've got an incredible solar storm that we observed here on Earth. We saw some really cool aurora in places that normally wouldn't be able to see it. Was there any impact to your robotic colleagues on the surface of Mars?
Well, the colleagues are doing well, but we actually have set them up to make observations. So, you know, we get these really incredible auroras on Earth, and on Mars, you can actually see some impact of the solar storm. So there are a couple of GIFs that have been put together that show basically, it almost looks like little like sparks in the sky, not quite like fireworks, but it sort of looks like maybe your camera lens is dirty, but it is actually the solar storm interacting with the Martian atmosphere. Getting that careful observation so that we can actually see something like that on Mars it's a careful game of getting your timing right, getting your expectations of when the storm's going to reach Mars right, and then being in just the right place at the right time.
All right, well, let's talk about the work ahead for them. I know Perseverance is getting ready to drill once more. Tell us a bit about the work ahead.
Actually, so Curiosity is going to drill even more soon probably than Perseverance. Yeah, I feel like I'm in a tale of two rovers right now, where both of these missions are climbing up fluvial channels, so basically river channels. We know water was flowing down them at some point in the deep past. And so with Curiosity, we are climbing up the Geddes Vallis channel. And we've actually just gotten to a place that we call White Bark Pass. And this looks like it's going to be our next drill location. We're at kind of the right place where we try to have equal cadences of when we stop to drill and ingest sample and do analyses with our internal instruments, so SAM and Kemen. There's some, you know, really neat looking textures in the rocks that are intriguing. And so we're looking forward to exploring those. So we're looking at drilling in the next little bit here at a place that we're calling Mammoth Lakes. which is also a really cool place on Earth if you ever get a chance to go out and check it out. But Mammoth Lakes, if the drill is successful, would be our 41st drill hole, which is really incredible. I mean, I feel like we're just putting up these marks of like, oh yeah, next drill hole complete. But I mean, before Curiosity, we had never drilled on another planet. And so it's just this incredible milestone every time we get a new successful drill hole.
That does seem like, is it 41 on Curiosity or 41 between all of them with Curiosity?
Oh, just 41 drill holes with Curiosity. So we've got 20 some odd sample tubes filled on Perseverance right now. So yeah, actually Perseverance is also exploring a river channel. So it has climbed up on the Delta fan, gone into sort of the margin between the fan and the crater rim, and is now kind of really getting close to the crater rim, getting ready to leave the margin in the crater. And so we're in what's called Naretva Vallis. So this is, again, another river channel. We have just gotten to this area called Bright Angel. And it really is this bright exposure of rock that we see from orbit using those amazing orbital assets that we have. And so we've had our eye on it, you know, since before landing. And it's always really exciting to see something you've been planning for, you know, literally years, and you finally get up to it. And it's really gorgeous outcrop. So trying to understand what it is, how it formed, what can it tell us about the presence of water in Jezero? Is there any astrobiological potential there? So, I mean, all of the really cool questions we get to ask on a daily basis with this mission.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with astrobiologist Amy Williams about the Mars rovers and their journey to study rocks that were once covered by water. I'm still stuck on the 41 drills because that's pretty incredible. Is there a concern that there's like a finite amount of these drill samples you can take because of the hardware? You know, I know my power drill that I have at home, it you know, those bits wear out pretty quickly. I know you'll have much better tools than I do, but is there a finite amount of drills that you can do?
So we do plan with some contingencies. So we've had a couple of different drill bits that we could switch out. If you have some wear and tear, you can switch it out. But, you know, honestly, we experienced one of our biggest sort of challenges a couple of years ago when the mechanism that's meant to make the drill, an issue was found with it that actually could have compromised our ability to do a lot of things. And so we were off drilling for quite a while the folks back on Earth put in an immense amount of effort to come up with a new way to drill in a way that the drill had never been intended to be used. And so, yeah, it's just really incredible when you think about like what we can kind of make workarounds for on Earth in order to maintain our ability to do the science that we're doing on other worlds. So we already had sort of this big ordeal of figuring out, you know, sort of extending the drill so that you're touching the drill directly to the rock instead of using, you know, we used to have these stabilizers that would tell us kind of where we were, and then you could put the drill into the rock. And so it was this whole thing to figure out a new way to drill. But since that happened, I mean, that's been years ago now, you know, we've collected, I don't remember our drill count at the time before all of this happened, but we have collected, oh, I would guess more than a dozen drill holes since we had to do that work. It's really impressive what we can accomplish, and what especially, you know, the engineers at JPL were able to do in their test beds to figure out a workaround. So yes, there are consumables. So far, we've been fortunate, and we also carefully select targets that shouldn't put undue pressure on the system and allow us to still collect really scientifically intriguing samples.
All right, so what I'm gathering is next time I have a home improvement project, I should call the folks at JPL for some help.
So, I'm sure your engineers could carve out some time.
All right, well, I know you're more focused on the science, Amy, and I do want to talk about the science. You mentioned where both Perseverance and Curiosity are right now. It's like a tale of two rivers. So they're both in rivers together. Is there a scientific advantage to being able to see data coming from these places and to compare them to one another?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everything about, you know, this is basically comparative planetology at its, you know, like finest resolution. So yeah, comparing two river channels that probably formed at very different time periods, that have different kinds of, may have had different, you know, geochemical fluids flowing through them that represent really sort of different eras on Mars, because we're in this really dry environment now with with Curiosity and Gale Crater, and you know, Perseverance, we're climbing out of this crater into this really ancient Milwaukeean terrain. So it's really cool to have sort of the comparison between them. How are these formation processes similar and different? We know water was flowing and carving, but you know, the materials that were flowing in that river, the rocks and sediments in there, all of that could have been quite different between the two systems. So it's like comparing, you know, the Mississippi River to, you know, some beautiful braided channel in Alaska, right? Like it's different systems, and what we're looking at are not braided channels on Mars at those two locations, but you can really make a lot of interpretations about how water was flowing, how much was there, all of this really neat, these neat interpretations you can make about ancient processes. So what's really cool when you get to river channels, just like on Earth, is that they cut down through the rocks and you get these really amazing exposures of cross sections of the rocks, of things that you may not have had the opportunity to see if you're just driving across these rocks, moving up in stratigraphy or up through the layers. And so that's really cool, especially in Gale Crater. We have these incredible deposits. I mean, we're going up kilometers of sediments. And you're getting a really incredible sort of cross-section, sort of like dog's eye view of like what these rocks look like. So yeah, we're learning quite a bit and sort of different things between the two missions as we are slowly ascending either a mountain in Gale Crater or a crater rim in Jezero Crater.
Oh, that's fantastic. Finally, Amy, I always want to ask you before we go, what are you most looking forward to with these two rovers? What's on the horizon, the Martian horizon?
The Martian horizon. I mean, yeah, so getting that 41st sample with Curiosity, I'm really excited about that. Like I said, there's some really cool textures in the rocks. There's like really neat looking spectra that we're getting. And so we're just really excited to see like what is actually going on with these rocks in this sulfate enriched environment that we've been climbing up through in Gale Crater. And then, of course, with Perseverance, you know, we're getting really close to the crater rim. And so we're going to go into a brand new terrain pretty soon. And that is really, I think that's going to be a huge shift, both in like the mission, the way that we are like thinking about the rocks that we're climbing through and sort of the discoveries that we're getting ready to make.
Amy Williams, thank you so much for joining us and keeping up to date on what's happening on Mars.
Of course.
That was Amy Williams, a mission scientist and astrobiologist at the University of Florida. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with the show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're AWTY Space. And if you've got an idea for a future episode of the show or you want to join us as a guest, reach out. We're at AWTY@cfpublic.org. We've got more space coverage online. Visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our producer is Marianne Summerall. Our intern is Sophie Diaz. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.